You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and you are very welcome to Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of author interviews and book reviews from around the Sound and beyond. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. Well, today we're going to go a little bit beyond our immediate environs, but we're going to talk to someone that most of you know. We're going to be talking to Anna Quinn, who's the author of The Night Child and a brand new novel, Angeline. Anna is the founder of the Writer's Workshop here in Port Townsend, and along with her husband, Peter, she definitely elevated Port Townsend as a magnet for literary endeavors in the entire Pacific Northwest. And that's according to Chris. So welcome, Anna.
Oh, thank you. That was such a beautiful introduction. I really appreciate it.
Not everybody gets that. Okay, so let's dive into this book. I found it really exciting to read and a page-turner, but also very beautiful and slow-paced, too. It's really a great book to read. And I'd like to ask you to begin today by just, you know, introducing a reading and letting us know how it feels.
All right. Well, I'm going to just read the first two chapters. They're rather short. And a lot of the images in these particular two chapters are the original images that came to me in dreams about this particular nun. So I will start now. Meg lies prostrate on the stone floor, her body a cross. Incense curls around her white gown and spirals up like tiny resurrections. When she rises, they dress her in black and call her by a new name, Sister Angeline. It is the 12th of December, 2014. She is 23 years old. She is now, after 6 years of discernment, officially a bride of Christ. The bishop, dressed in reds and blacks, slides a gold band on her ring finger. A choir of nuns sing the Psalm de Profundis, a celebration of her death to worldly things. They sing something beyond the swell of human voice, something closer to white birds wrapping her in silk and promising to be there when she emerges. And she stands there among them, head lifted toward light pouring through stained glass windows. It is then, when she opens her eyes, she sees the baby floating in the perfumed clouds of smoke, a crown of lilies on its tiny head. Sister Angeline wipes her eyes, her face, and whispers, "I love you," and the baby flies away through the night. With the exception of singing and chanting and an hour of conversation each day, the 20 nuns live together in complete silence, their daily lives divided by bells moving them from one prayerful hour to the next, reminding them to pay attention to the moment. Even though there are no cell phones, computers, televisions, or radios, and the windows are frosted, a cloistered nun can become distracted. The first bell rings at 12:30 a.m. for matins, and Sister Angeline rises from her bed, kneels, and places her forehead on the floor, attempts to relinquish ego, washes her face, dresses in full habit, but leaves her feet bare. It is a breach of discipline to hurry, so she moves steadily, not with haste, and strives to stay in a perpetual state of prayer. Once the nuns are gathered in the chapel, the prioress, Sister Josephine, exposes the Blessed Sacrament. She opens the door to the tabernacle, and there in the form of wine and wafer lies the body and blood of Christ. Sister Angeline, absorbed by this metaphor, the thought of all becoming one body, no one separate from the other, but there are those who drink the wine and eat the bread, who still feel alone, afraid, hungry, desperate, and ashamed. She is one of those. Pray, eat, chant, clean, cook, read. Pray, eat, chant, clean, cook, read. The monotony drives some of the nuns away. The monotony kills some of them. For Sister Angeline, the surrendering, the predictable rhythm carries its own body, its own blood, its own redemption. Marriage between humans is a dare, a summons, a trial. Marriage to God is a microscopic introspection, a quantum leap, a release, a chrysalis. That's it. I'll stop there.
So the reader may has questions right away, and questions that need answering. And that's kind of a theme of the book, of every, the questions within the book and how will they be answered. One thing is that this isn't 100 years ago. The setting is pretty much now in the 2000. Am I correct about that?
Right.
Yeah.
2014. Yeah.
So to be cloistered, has a lot of restrictions on normal life. Are there still groups of women that are living this way?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. They're all across, I just focused on the United States, but they're all across the world. And yes, they are very much in existence.
So this book, just like The Night Child, has a lot of psychological questions, and the way that you peel back the answers for us is not necessarily through conversation, but in these flashes of memory for Angeline. And I thought about The Night Child and, how that was such a psychological novel of something deeply hidden. Is this something that you think you're going to continue to write about?
It is interesting. I was thinking about that with The Night Child, the similarities. They both have this kind of haunted sense, and they both have ghostly visions. They deal with ghosts of the past and that fragile line between past and present. And I didn't think Angeline would really be about that. I didn't really go into it with any particular agenda.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw that I was exactly writing into that again. I was writing into ghosts of the past. I was writing into exploring identity and how grief and loss and suffering impacts who we are and shapes who we are becoming. So I think there's a good chance I'll be writing into that for a while. I'm working on a third novel that is also exploring that in a completely different way.
Mm-hmm.
So it's absolutely something I'm interested in.
Well, I think that you can continue your entire career this way because it offers so much to the reader personally. And
mm-hmm.
I think
a
lot of people can enjoy the characters and the plot and, just the descriptions, but also start to think about things in their own life. So congratulations on that. Well, yeah, let's go on to the setting. There's a huge leap, and that is just an incredible switch. Tell us about where she ends up.
Well, she ends up on an island, and that was also a surprise to me. So much of the story came through in my dreams, and three of the strongest images were of the cloister, the constrained feeling in Chicago, the island, and the ocean. And so I knew that I would be developing those images as powerful characters. And I love exploring how place changes us and how we change it, how it can show the passage of time, and it also reinforces the changes in our identity. But this particular combination was really absorbing for me to explore, because the cloistered convent has such a deep, deep history of hierarchy and submission, and the reminder of the vows of obedience and poverty, celibacy. So, and there were clear expectations on how to behave. And so then when Angeline is sent to the island, it was exactly the opposite of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the island held its own history, it had its own politics, and it had freedom and diversity of attitudes. And, there were no strict expectations of how to behave. And so this was startling for her, because she'd been in the cloister for 7 years, and she went in at 17. So, and she, even before the accident that killed her family, she was a very much an isolated human, mm-hmm. an isolated young woman.
Mm-hmm.
So she has to deal with that changes. And then I had to allow the environments to be a stimulus for her in whatever way, it needed to be. So
Yeah, so you talk about going to the island, but you didn't mention that she's now in a very progressive and liberal convent. So can you describe this place for us? What did it look like?
Oh, it's so beautiful. Mm-hmm. I created a place where I would personally like to live.
Right.
It's a compound of yurts. There's five other sisters there. They each have their own yurt. And it's on a 300-acre farm with an apple orchard. And they raise goats and they have gardens. But the fact that they each have their own space is very different. That was also a shock to Angeline. And there's a whole chapter about how she feels when she first walks through the door of her own yurt.
Mm-hmm.
And how they fixed it up, there was her own bathroom, and she had a mirror, and the mirror was so symbolic of many things in the story. But the sisters themselves, so now the word changes from nun to sisters. The word nun is used when you're speaking of a woman who is in a cloistered convent. When nuns go out into the world, they are then called sisters. But these particular nuns did not even want to be called that. They just went by their names.
Mm-hmm. And they wore the clothes that they chose to wear.
Their regular clothes.
Yes, yes. So then there are the sisters that are there, and they all seem to be like special allies for Angeline. I was thinking of the word archetype, but it's not quite that. But each one is a facet of modern society. And so how did you decide about who they would be and what they would represent?
You know, it's interesting. It's very much like with the Night Child. I feel that I don't have a lot of say in who the characters that emerge. Once I begin taking, you know, when I decided I would be able to write about Angeline, and I began taking walks with her, long walks every day, and asking questions and kind of just allowing the story to unfold in my mind. And I went from night dreaming to the daydreaming part of the story, that each character emerged on their own. And I thought that was, you know, they were fascinating to me. And I wondered if it was going to end, like how many were there going to be? They kept coming out of the yurt. So
they kept coming out of the yurts. I love it. Not hobbits.
But yeah, they each had their own story. Mm-hmm. But the most of the story is about Angeline,
and
it's an interior. As you can see, it's an interior journey, and also with the Night Child, I didn't really explore all the other characters in that book, and I didn't really do that in this one because I so wanted to focus on her and give her a voice and just let it be her story from her perspective.
You are listening to Book Lovers Cafe, and this is Chris Wilson, your host, and I'm talking to Anna Quinn about her new book, Angeline. And it will be released soon, and you will hear this before and after probably its release, but keep an eye out for it. And this is KPTZ 91.9 in Port Townsend, and let's continue talking to Anna. So it's not all sweetness and light here in the yurt compound. No, it's not a compound. But anyway, it's so delightful. But there are other people that live on the island. So it's not like a teeny tiny place. I sort of pictured Guamas, or Shaw, or one of the islands in the, you know, San Juans. Did you kind of have a certain island, and was there a place like this that ever existed there, out there?
Well, there is a place called Shaw Island, and it very much held some seeds to the story for me because it had at one time three different orders of nuns that lived on that island, and I first visited it when I was on a solo camping trip when I was 17, and I didn't really have any set destination to go. But when we pulled into Shaw Island, there was a nun in full habit, a brown habit, who was running down to pull in the ropes of the ferry, and then other nuns joined her. And I couldn't believe it. I thought, what is happening? What is this place? And so I got off the ferry there, and I learned about the different orders that were there. And later I would go back a couple times and stay at the monastery, the Benedictine one, and just you're allowed to go work there and help with the farm. And so I absolutely absorbed much of that culture there. Uh-huh.
So that's because, you know, it seems so authentic. It doesn't just seem like you walked on the beach and kind of dreamed this up. So that helps anchor this for me. So then there's also, I won't call it, you know, the villain, but there is an opposing anti-liberal force on this island, as there are in so many places, so many idyllic places. And kind of a very strict Catholicism personified by Father Matt. Was he anybody that you've run into in your life?
I will just call him a composite character.
Yes.
You know, I have to say that in order to also ground the story, I grew up Catholic, and I went to Catholic schools, and I was a Catholic school teacher. I was a Catholic school principal, and I quit the church at least seven different times, and ultimately I quit it for good. Mm-hmm. That's what I thought until this story came into my mind, and I still have quit.
You still have quit. So, that was so kind of hard for you to say, Anna. No, I understand. I mean, it's so just in every fiber.
I was fortunate to have experiences with truly extraordinary nuns and have always been completely fascinated by them. And, you know, they represented, especially when I was a teenager, female rebellion, unapologetic female boldness. They weren't defined by their physical bodies. They weren't married. They didn't have children. They said no to anything conventional. And they chose to live on the margins. They weren't put on the margins. They chose to live there. So I had a deep respect and fascination for them. They spoke to the rebel in me.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I also, when I was 17, spent some time in a convent for a 2-week discernment process. But I only lasted a few days because I just couldn't assimilate God as a male character.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't assimilate the atrocities in the church. So I didn't stay with that track of path in my life. But as a writer, I had the opportunity to write a different story. And I've wanted to write about, well, what if there was a secular convent? What if we could live in a way that wasn't necessarily transcribed by men, transcribed by societal mores that we had followed for hundreds of years? So that was a big what if in my mind, how to create that.
Right.
But like all good things, there are those components that come in, and in this book, in the form of Matt and the sheriff, and a certain part of the population, too.
Right. But I want to be clear to our listeners that this book is by no means sort of an attack on religion or an attack on the Catholic Church. There's a lot of spirituality and mysticism in this story. And I think there is that feeling in your life, just talking about your process of writing. And there's also quite a bit of poetry in this book. And
thank you.
And so not only in the prose writing, but also some excerpts. So can you go to page 182 and 183 and maybe read a little bit of that?
Okay, hold on just one second. So let's see.
Just the poetry part. It's fine.
Okay, so this is a part where she is taking some time away from the other sisters and just spending time on her own to process some of her grief. So let's see. And with each passing day, Sister Angeline's insomnia increases. She thought she'd settle into her solitude, allow the black and white of it to help her clarify things, regroup, replenish. She thought she'd been hungering for it, an itch she has no words for, though the words oneness and touchstone come close. But she'd forgotten the hazards of isolation, how a shallow river of doubt can become a bottomless pool of grief, how thoughts can circle like panicked yellow-eyed beasts, sneering orange tongues, unable to find a way out, how voices inside her mouth can scream, "Who do you think you are?" But when she walks near the water, catches its rhythm, something pulls her away from the destruction, the disintegration, urges her towards light, and shapes her mind into something like white clouds in the shape of fish swimming. She comes upon a particularly large tide pool now, crouches low and stares into it. Red and scarlet anemones the size of her hands unfurl their luminous fringed tentacles. Miniature crabs rush around, and an orange starfish lies heavy in the swaying green algae. A thin, translucent worm floats, floats, floats into the anemone's pulsing embrace. But now tentacles jerk and tighten, and the worm disappears. The wide mouth closes. Moments later, the anemone unfolds like a delicate flower, as if the worm never existed.
And so that's a part that the reader can read a few times, as poetry often leads us to do. And you also talk about the poet Rilke and how important he is in her early life. And so I think it's on page 190. Yes, 190 at the bottom of the page.
Yes.
I think that this is an important message in the story as well. And can you share that with us and talk about it if you'd like to?
Yeah, so she makes a friend on the island, an EMT named Colin, and they are on his, he lives on a tugboat, and so they're there, and she's looking around, and on the bulletin board, she sees some poetry, and he says, I'll start reading from there. "Ever read Rilke?" Colin asks. "Many times. Me too." He turns to her and holds the knife in the air like a sword, like he's giving a performance, his voice deep and dramatic, and recites a passage. "Be patient toward all that is unresolved in your heart, and try to love the questions themselves. Live the questions now. Perhaps you will then gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answer." She claps and he takes a bow. "I've always liked those words, at least conceptually," she says. "But there are so many questions that find me and demand things." And I'll stop there.
Mm-hmm. There are so many questions. And so that's a continuing theme in this story. And we're doing such a great job of pulling out parts of the book without revealing anything about the plot. I love it.
You are. Yeah.
So I just want to, you know, pique everybody's interest in this. There is a flashback where Angeline thinks about something her aunt told her, the three ways to combat flashbacks. And I was wondering if you know, subscribe to that advice?
Well, I see where that is. Yes, she lived with her aunt for a little bit after the accident. And her aunt was a pretty sturdy, hard-edged person. And at one point, because Meg wasn't getting, her name was Meg before she was Sister Angeline, and she wasn't getting out of bed. So I'll just read a little bit from that. Her aunt, holding a cigarette in one hand, placed the list on her pillow, taking a deep drag, the smoke rising to the ceiling and curling in a cloud there, and said, "God damn it, you should be grateful you're alive." And she gave her this piece of paper. And when Meg opened it, I'm not reading that part. I'm just telling you. On the paper, it said, "Three tools to cope with flashbacks. One, press your feet firmly into the ground. Two, breathe in a comforting scent. Three, write three affirmations and repeat them each morning." And so Meg does this, but instead what happens, she reads it, she tries it. Instead, it causes her to have an even more serious flashback.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't exactly...
didn't really work for her.
It didn't really work for her. She needed something a little deeper. Well, mm-hmm. Anna, I have to say that our time has just flown by here. And, you know, here we are. I want to read something that's in the publicity about the book. A moving and lyrical, melancholy and spiritual novel by the acclaimed author of Night Child, in which Sister Angeline, unwillingly sent to a radical convent and confronting her tragic past, asked the deep question, follow your heart or follow the rules? And so with that, I will say adieu to you, Anna Quinn, and I hope to see you in Port Townsend at a reading. Thank you so much for joining us today on Book Lovers Cafe. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. If you jumped in the middle of this, you can go to the podcast page and find it under Book Lovers Cafe. And I want to thank our engineer and editor, Taylor Clark, for the great work he does, and all the volunteers and supporters who make this wonderful radio station possible.
Today's closing music is The Story by Brandi Carlile.
Stories of where I've been, and now I got to where I am. But these stories don't mean anything when you've got no one to tell them to. It's true, I was made for you. I climbed across the mountain.